I am from Bhutan.
I am from Algeria.
From Ecuador.
From Moldova.
From Romania.
I'm from Somalia.
I'm from Italy.
From Russia.
But I am also from New Hampshire.
I'm also from New Hampshire.
This is New Hampshire's immigration story.
The history of New Hampshire can't really be told without the story of immigration and refugees, because except for Native Americans, that's what we all are.
They have been the workers, people we use to build our railroads, to run our mills, very often doing some of the dirty work.
I truly believe that if we were made of a single layer of fabric, we would not have the strength and resilience that we do. But because all of these things are intertwined, I believe that the social fabric of New Hampshire is made better.
They've come for economic opportunities. They've come to escape war, famine, and persecution. They've come to join family, and they've come to become Americans. They've arrived from just about every country, from Ireland and Canada, Lithuania and Poland, from the Congo, Somalia, Iraq, and Bhutan. And they landed here in the Granite State to start anew. Welcome to New Hampshire's Immigration Story. I'm your host, Keith Shields. Immigrants were arriving in the Granite State long before there was actually a Granite State. David Thompson, a Scotsman, was our state's first foreign-born resident. He settled at Ordeon Point, which is now Rye, New Hampshire, in 1623, and set up a fishing company. After that came men and women from southwest England. They too came here seeking business opportunities. They were followed by what we now call Scots-Irish, Protestants from Ulster County in Northern Ireland, who laid roots in the settlement of Nutfield, now called Londonderry. We also had people coming from the south as well, Puritan rebels kicked out of Massachusetts. But a significant growth begins in the early part of the 19th century, and the backbone of that story is a river called the Merrimack. That river would prove to be a magnet for tens of thousands of immigrants over the next century. Part 1. Ambuscade. For centuries, Native Americans have been attracted to the waters of the Merrimack River, specifically an area called Ambuscade. Here they came for sturgeon, alewife, and shad. But it was a man named Samuel Blodgett who saw something more.
I characterize him as the Benjamin Franklin of Manchester.
Robert Perot is a Manchester historian and author of the book Vivre la Différence, Franco-American Life and Culture in Manchester, New Hampshire.
He was everything. You know, he was a lawyer, he was a judge, he was a farmer, he was an inventor, he was an industrialist. He's better known for building the first canal around Ambuscade Falls.
Blodgett had traveled to Manchester, England, and saw the booming textile mills there, and envisioned a new Manchester, this one in America. So he returned to New Hampshire, built a home on the river in an area called Derryfield, and in 1793 went to work on building a canal. In 1807, Samuel Blodgett's canal was completed, but he would never see his dream fulfilled. Blodgett died only a few months later. Shortly after, town fathers changed the name Derryfield to Manchester. Soon small mills started popping up along the river. Aurora Eaton, executive director of the Manchester Historical Society, says that this stretch of the Merrimack was tailor-made for industrial development.
In this particular location, we have something called Ambuscade Falls. It's about a third of a mile long, where the river drops 54 feet total. It's not one big waterfall, but it's a series of rapids, so there was a lot of water power because of that drop in the river. And that's what was harnessed, actually, to make all these mills work in Manchester. It's the best water power site on the Merrimack River.
Boston investors thought so as well, and in 1831, these men who helped build the cities of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Lowell, Massachusetts, purchased 15,000 acres along the Merrimack River in Manchester and started Ambuscade Manufacturing. Ambuscade began as a land development company, but in 1837, the investors began to realize Samuel Blodgett's vision, not only breaking ground on giant textile factories, but New England's only large-scale planned city. Once again, Aurora Eaton.
It wasn't just building the canals and building mill buildings. In 1838, they laid out the center part of the city, so there had to be people there as engineers and as just laborers doing digging and chopping down trees and building houses like crazy and building business blocks downtown. They were literally creating a city from scratch.
At first, labor was easy to find. Men from nearby farms looking for employment did the building. Teenage girls and young women looking to provide for their family became the mill's first workers. But by the 1840s, the demand for workers became insatiable. David Waters is a professor of New England culture and literature at the University of New Hampshire.
Surely there were just not going to be enough young women on the hill farms of New Hampshire. Also, some of the New England women did not like the way in which labor was becoming increasingly industrialized and the more difficult work conditions and the longer hours, the bad air, and they began to have some labor activism. So employers began to look overseas.
And about that time, the potato famine hits Ireland. Irish men and women started trickling over to New Hampshire in the 1820s and 30s. And by the 1840s, they become the Granite State's first major population of immigrants. Potato blight had caused 1 million Irish to starve. Those that didn't felt the oppression of British rule. So many left. They would go to Boston first, but by the mid-1840s, the mills were growing along the Merrimack River, while railroads were being built as fast as the mills. Stuart Wallace is a professor of history at New Hampshire's Technical Institute and former director of the New Hampshire Historical Society.
When it came to railroad jobs, nobody wanted to do that. And so we quickly realized that we were only too happy to give this job to immigrants.
And so over the next two decades, more and more Irish arrived, settled, and worked in New Hampshire, mostly in its large cities, and most working in the mills. By 1850, there was over 1,300 Irish in Manchester alone. And by 1860, that number triples. But as New Hampshire's first major immigrant group settled, the first major anti-immigrant feeling started brewing in our state as well.
The Catholic population in the United States just mushrooms between 1840s and 1860s.
Lucy Salyer is an associate professor of history at the University of New Hampshire.
And when you put it into the context, especially in a place like New Hampshire, which was historically very Protestant and also historically very anti-Catholic, there was a heritage of a great distrust of Catholics. And Irish Catholics really bore the brunt of this.
New Hampshire natives had a love-hate relationship with these Irish Catholics. The Irish provided the workers who built the entire city that they now enjoyed. They laid down the railroads and provided a large part of the workforce for a burgeoning Amaskeg manufacturing company. But the Irish worshipped differently, and the Catholic churches that sprung up engendered fear and revulsion, as the diary of Manchester resident Joseph Kidder illustrates.
The most dangerous system of religion, if it be not a desecration to call it a religion, is the Roman Catholic. The subjects are simply so many suppliant tools in the hands of Pope, Bishop, and Priest to carry out just what desires these men may require. They are void of a conscience. Their conscience is in the keeping of the priest. It's a dangerous doctrine.
But it was more than just religion. They spoke differently, acted differently, had different beliefs. And for the more established Granite Staters, the Irish drove wages down. John Clayton is a former columnist for the Union Leader newspaper and author of 7 books on Manchester history.
Many of them spoke Gaelic, and if you could not understand what someone was saying, you were immediately looked upon with distrust. And there was the always ever-present economic factor. If the Irish were coming in, that meant they were taking jobs from someone else. And again, as is often the case, the immigrants were willing to work for less because they desperately needed the money.
So as Boston businesses began to hang signs that said Irish need not apply, the Irish could still work in the mills of New Hampshire. But their treatment outside the mills was getting more and more tense.
One passage I came up with was that in describing these foreigners, shorthand for Irish.
These are children of foreigners who make not a small part of our population. They are daily spending their time in the streets in idleness and incipient dissipation, disturbing the peace of our citizens by their
profane, obscene, blasphemous language. And that was a direct shot at the Irish, and that's the spirit with which they were greeted.
By the 1850s in New Hampshire, the tensions between the state's natives and its newer Irish Catholics grew and grew until it reached its breaking point on the 3rd of July, 1854.
Early 1850s, New Hampshire, the rest of the nation, was undergoing a lot of stress.
The stress came from a debate on slavery that divided the country, but it also came from a debate on the immigrant. Irish and German Catholics were arriving in droves. Anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic speakers fanned nativist flames. One of these was a man named John Orr, better known by his nickname, the Angel Gabriel, who appeared in Manchester on June 24th. Historian Stu Wallace.
Angel Gabriel was a neat guy. He was this complete lunatic, dressed up as an angel with a big horn, and he'd stand on the street corners, bring attention by beeping his horn, and then he'd come up with all this nasty racial bigotry stuff.
That same month, Michael Kalin, an Irishman, got into a fight with a former state representative by the name of John Marshall, who bludgeoned Kalin to death with his monkey wrench. Marshall was arraigned and ordered to stand trial for murder. Tensions were rising, as was the summer heat. Former columnist John Clayton.
It's hot. They're living in tenements. There's no air conditioning. There's no refrigeration. Everybody's out on the stoop. Everybody's out in the park in what was the largest urban area in New Hampshire at the time. Tempers get a little short. People may take too much of their favorite beverage in an attempt to stay cool. And cooler heads do not always prevail under those circumstances.
A gang of Irishmen gathered, smashing windows and assaulting two native-born Granite Staters. By the next day, a mob of 500 had gathered, seeking revenge. An article in the Manchester Union Democrat, a paper sympathetic to the Irish cause, picks up the story.
A large number of men, armed with clubs and other destructive implements, about daybreak, commenced an assault upon all the Irish houses in that neighborhood. Some 10 or 15 were pretty thoroughly dismantled, the doors and windows of many of them being completely stove in. The rioters next proceeded to the Catholic Church, just rebuilt at great cost and probably the handsomest in the state, and continued their fiendish work.
The church was St. Anne's Parish, Manchester's first Catholic church. It might have burned that night if it weren't for a man by the name of John Maynard, a prominent builder. Once again, John Clayton.
John Maynard stood out there in his nightshirt, and with one hand he beseeched them to stop, but it was the other hand that made them stop because in his other hand he held a pistol. John Maynard was a Protestant, and he did not like what was happening, and he stopped the mob from destroying this bastion of Catholicism in Manchester, St. Anne's Parish. And strangely enough, years later, they built a school in the neighborhood, and the Irish community from St. Anne's petitioned the city fathers in Manchester to name the school in his honor.
After the riots of 1854, tensions remained, but there were no other major outbreaks of violence against these immigrants. Over time, the Irish began to assimilate more and more. In 1859, Manchester elected its first Irish mayor, Edward Harrington. In the Civil War, the Irish fought side by side with their fellow Granite Staters. And by the time the troops returned home, a new immigrant began to arrive from the north. And they would change the cultural environment of New Hampshire for good. The French story is unique, in part because of simple geography. Unlike immigrants from Europe, the French Canadians didn't face a long, dangerous, and expensive journey from their homeland. And most didn't arrive in New Hampshire helpless and penniless. For them, home was just a day's train ride away. So, some come, some stay, some go back, and maybe return.
On va jouer dans ton parc. Que c'est qu'il y a?
By the later decades of the 19th century, Franco-Americans outnumbered all other immigrant groups in New Hampshire. And their presence is felt today. Even though it was Robert Perrault's grandfather that emigrated from French Canada, he still carries on many of his culture's traditions. He speaks fluent French, as does his son. Now, they're passing that tradition on to his granddaughter. This impulse to preserve tradition has been pronounced among Franco-Americans. Other ethnic groups have come to New Hampshire and quickly tried to assimilate. Many of the French did not.
There was a socio-historic aspect to it. When England conquered French Canada, they told their conquered subjects, "You will become Protestant and you will learn English." Well, that didn't work. They resisted. In fact, there was even a phenomenon known as la revanche du berceau, the revenge of the cradle. Let's outnumber these English people. Let's have tons and tons of kids, and we'll just outnumber them. So they still have the power and the money, but we're just so numerous that we can just do what we want. And eventually, that's kind of what happened.
And so according to Robert Perot, what French Canadians refer to as la survivance was a mindset carried to their new home.
The idea was that the French language was connected to the Catholic faith. The two worked hand in hand. There's another saying, qui perd sa langue perd sa foi. He who loses his language loses his faith. Well, they didn't want to lose those two, and plus their traditions, their culture, and all. So when they came here to work in the mills, they had this idea that they were not going to become assimilated. They were going to live in their own neighborhoods and continue in an urban industrial setting the same life that they had had in a rural agricultural setting.
And so that's what they did in places like Suncook, Berlin, and on the west side of Manchester. There were French parochial schools, French hospitals, French-only newspapers. And the biggest drivers of La Survivance were the curés, or French Catholic priests. NHTI history professor Stu Wallace.
The curés were almost like a big city boss in a sense. They're not just the religious figure who runs the community, but they're the ones who will answer the needs of their parishioners. And they're going to be organizers behind insurance companies, sports teams, social clubs, benevolent clubs. There were a lot of benevolent organizations out there to help workers and ethnic groups because there's no other support group. If you're injured at work, there's no workers' comp. And so these benevolent groups, which were ethnic in nature, would step in and try to help the member of your community who was injured or out of work or whatever.
Perhaps the most influential of all these curés was Monsignor Pierre Hevey, assigned to St. Marie's Parish on the west side of Manchester in the late 1800s. John Clayton.
Monsignor Pierre Hevey had a tremendous sense of foresight in terms of how he could serve his flock. Yes, they built a magnificent church, but he knew that there were needs that the church itself could not meet.
So he created St. Peter's Orphanage for the Franco-American children and Notre Dame de l'Or, its hospital. But probably Father Hevey was best known for starting the nation's first credit union, right in Manchester, New Hampshire. Originally, it was called La Caisse Populaire St. Marie, and later it changed its name to St. Mary's Bank. The year was 1908, and Father Hevey had heard about a new movement of banking going on in Quebec, started by a man named Alphonse Desjardins. So he brought Desjardins down to speak to his parishioners.
Now, if you give workers an easy access to a reservoir of funds with easy interest and payment terms, it changes everything. The cooperative association is not one of capital funds, but of people. Each member, regardless of his contribution in capital, is on a perfectly equal footing with all of his fellow members. That is to say, each has but a single vote.
That night, 102 members joined La Caisse Populaire St. Marie. More than a century later, St. Mary's Bank is still going strong. There's a wealth of information on our website, nhpr.org, including old immigration photos from my trip to both the Manchester Mill Yard Museum and the American Credit Union Museum, which was home to the original offices of St. Mary's Bank. You'll also find a lot of other fascinating photos and all shows and stories we've done for the series. I'm Keith Shields. New Hampshire's immigration story continues in just a moment here on NHPR.
Welcome to New Hampshire.
Welcome to New Hampshire.
This is New Hampshire's immigration stories.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, and this is New Hampshire's immigration story. Today, we're taking a 200-year-plus tour of our state's immigration history, from the early mill workers to the refugees who are living in the Granite State today. By the end of the 19th century, New Hampshire's immigrant culture was changing. Hundreds, then thousands of new men and women from new lands were arriving, to seek opportunity in the Granite State. Some were escaping bloody wars and oppressive regimes. Others would be recruited for their talents and skills. New Hampshire was starting to look more and more like a melting pot. Stu Wallace, a professor of history at New Hampshire's Technical Institute, paints us a picture of what it must have looked like.
About 1880, 1890, you start to bring in more immigrants from Central and Southern Europe, also far northern, where Scandinavians start to come in. And by 1900, you're beginning to see a steady flow now of especially Greeks, Italians, some Poles. There wasn't a Poland on the map yet at this time, but there were Polish people who were wanting to get out of there. And you began to see more Russians coming over, both Russian Jews and Russian Orthodox. And in time, you're going to start to see whole neighborhoods of Italians or whole neighborhoods of Greeks.
These new groups would at first find the same kind of opportunity their predecessors did. But the boom times didn't last. Millwork started to slow. The Depression would hit. Then the First World War would start, and Americans would become more distrustful of the foreigners. Part 2. New Immigrants, New Problems.
Thou wert so rich and strong of yore, Amaskeg, old Amaskeg.
By the early 1900s, the Amaskeg mill was earning its reputation as the textile capital of the world. There may have been other cities that produced more cloth, but none had a mill that compared to Manchester's.
No other single textile factory in the world had 17,000 workers, and it had around 30 buildings at one time, and it was turning out cloth of 50 miles per hour.
Robert Perot is a Manchester-based historian and author of the book Vivre la Différence, Franco-American Life and Culture in Manchester, New Hampshire.
They would say from Manchester to Boston, or 600 miles a day in a 12-hour day. And so you've got production, you've got people, and you've got space. In fact, there's a photograph that you see at the Manchester Historic Association's Mill Yard Museum that shows one day's production. And it's this gigantic room with all these bolts of cloth just stacked up. It's just amazing to see. 600 miles a day.
The breaking dawn reveals the way. Amaskeg, old Amaskeg.
The people who were running the machines that made the cloth were immigrants. And as more arrived, the talk in these mills began to sound different. By 1916, 28 languages were said to be spoken in the mills along the Merrimack River. New Hampshire historian Stu Wallace.
Amaskeg manufacturing used to actually seek diversity. The story was they sought diversity because they wanted to cut down the possibilities of unionization. Well, regardless of what was on their motive, you had a diverse population. They often divided different rooms into different ethnic groups. So you might have Lithuanians in one place, Russians in another, Poles in another, Italians in another. You actually had ethnic groups themselves, not the foremen. The foremen would be English, Irish, and only by the very end of the 19th century do we start getting some Franco-American foremen.
As Amaskeg grew, it also diversified. The company was gaining a reputation for its linens and winning international awards for its textiles. Amaskeg needed workers with skills that could only be found overseas. So once again, the mills looked to Europe.
The undersigned hereby agree to engage as gingham or check loom weavers with the Amaskeg Manufacturing Company of Manchester, New Hampshire, United States of America, for the period of 12 calendar months, to commence and be computed from the 15th day of June, 1868 years, and promise to do their work well and faithfully and to the best of their abilities, working the regular hours at the rate of payment current in the factory, doing the same type of work.
Ezekiel Straw, who was the agent for the whole company, he was a very visionary kind of guy.
Aurora Eaton is executive director of the Manchester Historical Society.
He wanted his company to be able to produce gingham cloth. Now, gingham is something that needs people who are dye masters to dye yarns, all different colors, and then they would weave them into plaids and checks. And really, nobody in the United States was doing it. So he went off to England and Scotland in particular and bought the machinery and actually had his people go out and recruit people who were the dye masters and who were the weavers who knew how to weave on the special loom. So they would actually come over here on a boat with the equipment and the chemicals to do all this gingham weaving. So there was this influx.
One of the recruits was the father of Tommy Smith, who came over to Manchester from Glasgow, Scotland in 1894. Tommy recounts his father's story in the book Amaskeg, Life and Work in an American Factory City.
In Scotland and England, they had advertised in the newspapers and put out flyers about the wonderful opportunities for weavers, spinners, and dyers in this country. The advertisements they put up were like circus posters. Wonderful conditions at Amaskeg in Manchester, New Hampshire. They showed a man just coming out of the mill yard with a wallet in his hand full of money, and he was going to the bank. Things like that induced people to leave.
Machinists from Germany were brought over, as were Swedes renowned for their fine lace making. Outside the mills, men from the Belgian cigar trade were brought to the 724 Cigar Company in Manchester, while Italian stonecutters were convinced to come to the Granite State and travel to its far north to help build mills in a new mill town called Berlin, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire's northern forest became part of the first great industrialized forest.
By the mid-19th century, lumber was a growing trade in northern New England. Millions of feet of pine, oak, and maple were being cut and sent across the country. Some of that wood was coming from a small town called Berlin, New Hampshire. In 1851, the railroad that was being built from Maine to Montreal passed through the town. Norwegian laborers working for the railroad settled there and became Berlin's first residents. Around the time that the Norwegians had arrived, a new use for the trees was being developed: pulp paper. No longer was rag pulp required to make newspapers and notepads. You could use the trees. Berlin was the perfect place for this method, says UNH professor David Waters.
This forest could be worked and a new product. You had to have fresh water to run the paper mills, but also you needed a place where you could assemble all that pulp wood. So that's what Berlin became famous for.
And almost overnight, tiny Berlin became a boom town. The Brown Company bought up smaller mills and became the dominant pulp and paper manufacturer in the area. Jobs brought new immigrants. Linda Uppenborenstein is a professor of history at Plymouth State University.
Brown Company specifically sought immigrants that were used to colder climates because they believed they would be able to endure the harsh winters in Coos County. So they actually went out and solicited different ethnic groups that they believed would meet that requirement.
They brought Irish, French Canadians, more Scandinavians, and later Eastern Europeans. But unlike the cities of Nashua and Manchester, where these groups tended to mix, in Berlin they settled in different parts of town.
You would expect them to cross those boundaries more and begin to coalesce and to begin to work together. Instead, they really were entrenched into their cultural identity and their community. Brown Company was actually involved in establishing an ethnic neighborhood for a group to kind of maintain that separate identity, to keep the groups together in some ways of maintaining peace. At the same time, there was controversy. It's complicated.
The group that had the hardest time assimilating, according to Linda Uppenborenstein, was the group that was last to settle, the Russians. Most other groups came with families, but many Russians arrived single. At that time, Berlin's main street had 19 bars and brothels. The single Russian men were regulars, so the Brown Company stepped in.
They actually went to Boston to contact a Russian church in Boston and agreed to pay for the construction of the Russian Orthodox Church, believing that if they got a minister in, he could provide some moral guidance to these young men. On top of that, he would be able to connect them to Russian women, and if they got married, they would establish the family connections and become a stabilizing influence in the neighborhood.
But family couldn't solve all of the Russians' problems. Anti-immigrant feeling was growing in the state and across the country. In 1882, the nation excluded Chinese from entering America. After that, we began to close our door to other groups.
You also started to see restrictions placed on what I would call what we would deem who was worthy to come to the United States.
Erin Corcoran is a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire.
And so we just started to exclude certain types of people for health reasons, people who were prostitutes, people who we thought might become a public charge, as if we were trying to select who we wanted to come in. You didn't have to show necessarily you had a reason for wanting to come to the United States. It was more undesirables who were kept out.
World War I was great for New Hampshire's immigrant workforce. The mills were booming and jobs were plentiful. But as thousands of Americans returned home from war, there was a growing distrust of the immigrant in general, and of Russians in particular.
Unemployment is high. In 1919 alone, there were something like 3,600 strikes in America. So we're looking for a scapegoat.
New Hampshire historian Stu Wallace.
The fear we had was when we looked at the Bolshevik, or what we call the Red Revolution in Russia, we heard the verbiage of people like Lenin talking about exporting the revolution to other countries, that this was an international movement, the workers of the world were going to rise up. And as a result of the economic problems here, we had strikes. There were anarchist bombings. Who knows who was responsible for half of those? And so there's a fear beginning to develop in the country by the middle to late 1919 that the Red Revolution was coming to the United States.
U.S. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and his young assistant J. Edgar Hoover had a plan to rid the country of these so-called subversives. On January 2, 1920, federal agents, along with local police, conducted a series of raids in New Hampshire and 23 other states. Stu Wallace picks up the story.
They just stormed into Russian homes, Russian workplaces, Russian baths and other clubs, and started rounding up Russians. They rounded them up in Berlin. They rounded them up in Claremont and Lincoln and Newmarket, Portsmouth, Nashua, Derry.
Get going!
Don't speak English.
Come on, come on.
Оставь меня!
What is this here? What are these writing?
They would round these people up and haul them by train. And these Palmer raids had no legal standing. I mean, they'd figure out where the Russians were living and just burst in on their homes. There's no search warrant, no warrant for arrest, no legal action, no judges involved. It must have been a terrifying experience because many of the Russians didn't speak the language, had no idea what was happening to them. To many of them, this looked like something that had happened back in Russia. Now it was happening in America.
260 people were rounded up in New Hampshire that day. The city of Nashua arrested 140 people alone, the largest single haul in the country. Yet most of these men and women weren't dangerous or a threat to the nation. According to Stu Wallace, most were an anarchist, communist. Some weren't even Russian.
In some cases, they rounded up just about anybody. They rounded up some Poles. They didn't know a single letter of the Cyrillic alphabet. At one point, they found something in Claremont written in a Cyrillic alphabet, and they decided that it was the constitution of the communist or the Bolshevik party of Claremont. Well, it wasn't. There was no such thing. In some cases, people were rounded up because they read Russian newspapers. Well, what else could they read? They only read Russian.
The 260 taken into custody that night were first sent to Concord. They eventually joined others rounded up from New England. They were brought to a prison in Boston Harbor, on Deer Island, the island which ironically was the first stop for many of these immigrants when they landed in America. The detainees faced deportation, but most weren't deported. Eventually, most were released. But there were long residual effects for the Russians. In 1920, New Hampshire had the 12th largest population of Russians in the country. But within a decade, many had left. Plymouth State University professor Linda Upham-Borenstein observed how it hit the city of Berlin.
From the Palmer raids, they identified at least 8 local residents from this new community as being communist sympathizers. Out of about 300 Russians, even though only 8 of the community is identified, everybody looked at the remaining Russians with suspicion and distrust. And so there was some tension that grew out of that. And many families then chose to leave. If you go to Berlin, the first thing that I noticed is that beautiful Russian Orthodox Church. And yet, church membership is almost non-existent. If you look in the 1929 Berlin Centennial book, they don't even call it the Russian Orthodox Church. They call it the Greek Orthodox Church, when at that time there were no Greeks in Berlin. They don't even want to make that connection.
On top of tougher immigration laws and stronger anti-immigration feelings, there were economic problems as well. Down south, wages were cheaper, the cotton needed for textiles was closer, and water power was no longer needed to run the mills. On Christmas Eve 1939, the company declared bankruptcy. Former union leader, columnist, and author John Clayton.
They made great efforts to try to bring Amoskeag back, but again, timing is everything. And from Christmas of 1935, we had the flood of 1936 in the spring. And it was amongst the greatest floods New Hampshire's ever experienced. And the buildings at Amoskeag, right on the banks of the Merrimack River, were literally filled to the second floor with mud and water and silt. So any effort to reopen those mills were crushed.
Amoskeag's tremendous factories, extending for a full mile north and south along the banks of the Merrimack River, assume the familiar look of a New England ghost town. Belatedly, Manchester, its one major industry gone, feels the full impact of economic adversity. The mill families, their savings exhausted, turn to relief and charity.
17,000 jobs in Manchester were tied directly or indirectly to Amoskeag manufacturing. And at the time, Manchester may have been a city of about 60,000 people. So think about it. One in every three persons in the city was dramatically affected by the loss of wages and revenue.
By the 1930s, tougher immigration laws all but closed the doors for many types of foreigners. Some inside the country, hit hard by the economy, returned to their homelands. It would be decades before migration grew again. But by the 1970s, new immigrants from new lands would start to come to New Hampshire, who would reshape our state once again. And that's coming up next on New Hampshire's Immigration Story. Visit our website at nhpr.org to watch a video of the NHPR players practicing the song Amoskeag My Amoskeag. You'll also find photo displays and maps, all the immigration shows we've done on The Exchange, and all the immigration stories from our news department and word of mouth. It's all at nhpr.org. I'm Keith Shields. You're listening to New Hampshire's Immigration Story here on NHPR.
New Hampshire na chacha sablu janpal exosesuni.
Marhaba bikum fi New Hampshire.
New Hampshire ma tapailai swagat.
Karibuni ku New Hampshire.
Welcome to New Hampshire.
This is New Hampshire Immigration Stories.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, and this is New Hampshire's Immigration Story. In the 150 years since the first major immigrant group started entering New Hampshire, much has changed. In Manchester, St. Anne's Catholic Church, the one that was nearly burned down by the anti-Irish mobs back in 1854, has merged with the nearby French-Canadian Catholic Church, St. Augustine's. Today, St. Anne's St. Augustine's caters to the melting pot of the Catholic cultures in the Queen City. The church has an English Mass, an African Mass, and Masses in Vietnamese and Spanish. Father Joseph Gerdak has been the pastor of St. Anne's St. Augustine's for 7 years and conducts most of the Masses.
It gives them a place to celebrate their own culture and to say that their own culture is good, that they are good as they face the American culture. We begin to appreciate more each other's culture when we come together and celebrate, so that we feel that we are not only different groups living here, but that we are truly a community.
El Señor esté con ustedes.
St. Anne's St. Augustine's is just one microcosm of a changing New Hampshire. Over the last few decades, our state has become home to new ethnicities and new cultures. And just like the past immigrants, these groups bring new challenges that opened up new debates over if we should allow immigrants and refugees into the state, and if so, how much should we support them? Part 3, the newest immigrants and the refugee. The most recent U.S. Census was conducted in 2010. By the end of the year, we began to learn more about how our state has changed. To crunch the immigration numbers, I spoke with Ken Johnson, senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute. Ken Johnson, thanks for taking time to talk with me.
You're welcome.
So, you've been crunching the numbers of the latest census in New Hampshire. What did it tell us about the number of foreign-born men and women now living in New Hampshire?
Well, there's about 69,000 foreign-born in New Hampshire, according to the latest data, and that's up from about 54,000 in 2000, which would be a difference of about 28%.
So that's a pretty big change for New Hampshire then.
It is. Certainly grew much faster than the population as a whole did, which only grew by about 6.5%.
So where are these newest residents coming from? What are the top countries?
Well, most of them are coming from Asia, with India and China being high on the list. New Hampshire has fewer Hispanics coming to it than many other parts of the United States when you look at its foreign-born population. And in particular, it has fewer Mexicans, even in its Hispanic population. There are as many people coming to New Hampshire from Brazil as there are from Mexico, which is pretty surprising compared to other parts of the United States.
So when you're looking at this, does this count for both immigrants and refugees or just immigrants?
The Census Bureau would report these as foreign-born. So in other words, this is everybody who was born in a country other than the United States. To the best of my knowledge, the Census Bureau doesn't break out refugees in its analysis.
Okay, so where are these people settling? What areas, what towns, what cities? Do you see any trends?
Well, certainly Hillsborough County is the biggest draw of foreign-born. Of the 69,000 foreign-born, about 32,000 live in Hillsborough County. Rockingham also draws a fair number, as does Merrimack, Stratford, and the other one that's interesting is Grafton. And if you want to look at cities, then Nashua has 12.3% foreign-born, Manchester has 11.5%, but Hanover has 15.2%. So of the cities I looked at, that actually was the highest percentage.
And would that count for just a lot of students coming in?
It might be. It also might be the technical staff in the big medical center at Dartmouth. I noticed that the Asian population in Hanover was particularly large, and so that would be quite typical. Highly trained technical staff would be one of the groups that would be drawn in this foreign-born population, particularly of Asians.
What other trends do you see with the newest foreign-born residents coming to and living in New Hampshire?
Well, they're certainly very well educated. One thing about the foreign-born population, this is true everywhere in the U.S., but the weighting of the two groups is different in New Hampshire. The foreign-born population is a sort of bifurcated population. It either has extremely high levels of education or it has low levels of education. And that's true in New Hampshire, except that the high education group is much larger. So in New Hampshire, about 48% of the foreign-born immigrants over the age of 25 who came to New Hampshire since 2000, that is the most recent immigrants, 48% of them have a bachelor or graduate degree. That compares to about 32% of the whole population over 25 in New Hampshire, so they're much better educated. They also tend to be more likely to be in married couple households. They tend to earn incomes that are very close to the income level of the population as a whole or of the native-born population. So, I mean, in many ways, they're not very different than the population that's already here.
And so what would you say those trends like a higher educated foreign-born population that makes as much as the average Granite Stater, what might that suggest about how they might shape our state in the coming years?
Well, New Hampshire has long depended on its well-educated population as a major resource to the development of the state. And so I would say that these foreign-born migrants to New Hampshire are certainly bringing with them that expertise and talent that will help New Hampshire to continue to grow and prosper.
And Ken Johnson, I know you're not clairvoyant, but just judging from the numbers, and you pay a lot of attention to this, how do you see the foreign-born population changing by the time of the next census in 2020?
Well, judging from the past trends, my expectation is that New Hampshire will continue to receive a modest number of migrants. That is, the proportion of the population that's foreign-born may go up modestly by a percent or two in the next decade. I suspect it will continue to get talented, well-educated migrants as the majority of its stream of in-migrants. But I don't think that New Hampshire is going to have a substantial increase in the size of its foreign-born population. And one other interesting thing when I was looking through the data, just looking back in history, right now New Hampshire has 5.2% foreign-born. In 1910, 100 years ago, it had 22.5% foreign-born. So it's not as if this is a high percentage for New Hampshire. It's actually quite low compared to what it's been historically.
Well, very interesting, Ken Johnson. Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Ken Johnson is senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute.
Refugees started to arrive in New Hampshire after World War II, and they were displaced Jews from the Holocaust, people from Europe who were refugees, had no place they could call home, were outside of their country of origin, and felt that to return would subject them to oppression or death. So the refugee status was meant to recognize that America was a special refuge, you know, that it does talk about that on the Statue of Liberty. It's not just the immigrant, it's the person who needs an asylum.
Refugees have become a large chapter in New Hampshire's immigration story. Vietnamese came in great numbers in the 1970s and 80s. They were followed by Bosnians and Croats in the 1990s. Then came refugees from African countries like Congo, Somalia, Nigeria, and the Sudan. Today, Iraqis and Bhutanese are resettling in the Granite State. In all, some 6,000 refugees have moved to New Hampshire since the 1980s. Four New Hampshire cities are federally designated resettlement areas: Manchester, Concord, Nashua, and Laconia. Amy Marshallton, Director of Services for New Americans at Lutheran Social Services in Concord, explains.
When a resettlement agency looks at placing refugees, there are several factors that have to be considered, transportation being one, social service agencies being another, in particular state programs like food stamps, Medicaid. Affordable housing is another aspect, employment opportunities, as well as being in proximity to grocery stores. The whole idea behind refugee resettlement is that refugees will become self-sufficient in every way possible as soon as possible.
But even with all those components, it's still not been easy, says Lutheran Social Services Vice President of Operations, Ann Dancy.
What we are able to provide to refugees is very limited in terms of financial opportunities. The opportunities that refugees develop, they develop on their own because they are living at a very subsistence level when they come here. So I think anytime you are really living a poverty level, you have all of the challenges that come with poverty: transportation, childcare. Just balancing your wants and needs with your income, it's just very challenging.
Bhutanese refugees are arriving in the greatest numbers these days. Since May of 2008, over 1,000 men and women have left refugee camps in Nepal and have come over to New Hampshire. As we began our series, New Hampshire's Immigration Story, I decided to follow one Bhutanese person as he tried to adapt to his first year in the Granite State. That person ended up being Ram Darji. Ram is 23 years old and lives in Concord. His wife Saraswati is 21. They have a one-year-old daughter, Angel, and also live with Ram's mother, Cheering. Ram and his wife lived in a refugee camp for over 17 years. So until they came to New Hampshire, the refugee camp was pretty much the only life they'd ever known. Last week, I paid my final visit to the Darji family as they neared their one-year anniversary of their arrival in the Granite State.
All right, ready, smile. Oh, shoot, I hit the on-off button. This is why I'm in radio.
It's a Friday evening in May, and the Darji family is winding down from another long work week. After today's visit, they plan on going grocery shopping, having dinner, and then, over the weekend, visiting friends and going to church. It's not that much different than probably many families in Concord this weekend. But for the Darjees, Even a simple weekend like this is light years away from how they were living less than 1 year ago in a refugee camp in Nepal.
All right, there you go. Ready?
Now the Darjees live in a nicely furnished apartment. Ram and his mother have full-time jobs. Ram is also learning English, and he has high hopes to enter New Hampshire Technical Institute this fall. Bhagirath Kadiwada was the Darjees' caseworker and has helped them over the past year to adapt to life in the Granite State.
Darji family has done great in the process of integration into the country. When they first came, they were quite worried how they could make their life beautiful and successful. But with the passage of time, they were able to get job. Then after having job, they bought their car, they got their license. So it's a great success. I should say that they are one of the exemplary figures among the community members.
But over the past year, I've seen a change in Ram. He looks tired. When I asked him how things were going, I got less than an enthusiastic okay. I asked them why.
First thing is, I'm thinking about studying. I'm head of household, and there are things going on in my mind about how to handle the family and how to manage to go back to school. There are a lot of obstacles.
Ram is correct about that. Most of the benefits that refugees receive in their first year have run out for his family. Add to that, he has a wife and a child to support and rent to pay. His English comprehension has improved immensely, but he still struggles with the language. Once again, Bhagirath Kadiwada.
Ram wants to go to college and earn a higher degree over here, but I think whether it could be successful. He wants to study, and in the meantime, he wants to work. I don't know how he is going to balance those two. He lived in the refugee camp for such a long period of time, so he didn't have exposure outside. It takes time for him to fill the gap in between refugee camp and America. But still, he's doing great. So earning higher degree could be one of the mechanisms for him to fill that gap.
Well, I think once refugees are established and they're looking beyond their first year, the idea of upward mobility is an issue for refugees.
Amy Marshallton is Director of Services for New Americans at Lutheran Social Services in Concord.
So once refugees get their foot in the door with employment, I think that they're interested in what we call job upgrades. Many times refugees are placed in the first available job, and it may not be reflective of their training or their expertise from their home country. And so I think after the first year of resettlement, many refugees are interested in trying to reclaim their lives in that way.
There have been other challenges as well, like getting used to American culture. Living in a refugee camp for most of his life, there was a lot that Ram was never exposed to.
In Bhutanese culture, people don't live together before getting married. It used to be arranged marriage, where parents were involved whether to marry with somebody or not. It has been changed to a love marriage, but love marriages is different than what is usually done in my country.
Ram has also been frustrated by his school-aged sisters, who have seemed to assimilate into American culture a lot faster than he has.
Here is over freedom. Sometimes I feel our culture is lost because it's very hard to direct kids to follow our own culture. We usually talk in a family and make a decision as a family, but here people make personal decision. Here parents cannot direct their children to wear right clothes, which is proper to their family. I think that's happening because kids are trying to adapt into American culture and interacting more with American girls, so they're acting more that way.
But despite the hard work and culture clashes, Ram Darji is incredibly grateful for his new life in the Granite State. When he asked if he's feeling American, he says he's getting more American. But he also says he misses his motherland of Bhutan, despite having very few memories of ever living there. But when I asked him if he would ever move back, if the political situation improved, he said he'd only go back to visit.
I think I can settle here instead of settling in Bhutan. By the time things would get better, I think I would start adapting more here. I came here to America committed to living here. I've been able to fulfill my dreams living here in America. I am proud to live here in America.
I asked Ram what, after a year, were his favorite things about living in New Hampshire. He pretty much told me that the Granite State had all the things that the refugee camp did not. It wasn't crowded, there wasn't much vandalism, and next to no robberies. But I wanted something tangible, so Rom told me that his other favorite thing about living in America was the fact that he had a car.
In Nepal, those people who used to own cars, they were really wealthy people. But here, everyone can buy a car and everyone can drive a car. It is a big freedom. I can go anywhere I like.
So for Ram, the car represents a very American ideal of freedom, something they never had in their nearly two decades in a refugee camp. This summer, they'll take their car down to Virginia to visit Saraswati's dad. It will be the first time they'll be together in 2 years. June 30th will be a big day for the Darji family. It's their daughter Angel's second birthday. It's also the couple's anniversary. But June 30th is also the day when 1 year ago, Ram, Saraswati, and Angel left the Nepalese refugee camp and took a 5-day journey to the Granite State to be the next small chapter in New Hampshire's immigration story. Go to our website at nhpr.org. There you'll find photo displays and maps, all the immigration shows we've done on the exchange, and all the immigration stories from our news department and word of mouth. It's all at nhpr.org. Funding for New Hampshire's immigration story is provided by the New Hampshire Humanities Council, the Gertrude Couch Trust, and the Norwin and Elizabeth Bean Foundation. Josh Rogers edited our program. Our readers were Ken Ekins, Priscilla Malcolm, Taylor Quinby, and Stephen Boyd. We also had help from Ellen Grimm, Andrew Perella, Brady Carlson, Courtney Kania, Jim McCann, Nilhari Bondari, and Boyan Moskoff. And I'm Keith Shields. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to New Hampshire's Immigration Story here on NHPR. ¶¶